From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, a spotlight on the brave women of Afghanistan and Iran. Our guest, Palwasha Kakar. She is the Director for Religion and Inclusive Societies at the U.S. Institute of Peace. According to USIP's website, Palwasha Kakar joined the organization after 4 years with the Asia Foundation, where she was the Afghanistan Director for Women's Empowerment and Development. Prior to joining the Asia Foundation, Kakar led the Gender Mainstreaming and Civil Society Unit in the UN Development Program's Afghanistan Subnational Governance Program. Kakar also served as Program Manager for the Gender Studies Institute at Kabul University. She has experience working with the World Bank Group on gender, social justice, and environmental issues surrounding their various projects in the region. An Afghan-American, Palwasha Kakar has experience teaching and researching religion, gender, security, and local governance. She has published research regarding women's participation in local governance, Pashtunwali Afghan customary law, Afghan women's identity, and social spaces in Afghanistan. Her research has taken her to Afghanistan, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Egypt, Israel, Palestine, Jordan, and Syria. Kakar is the co-author of the recent article, Iran's Protests and the Afghan Sisters Next Door. As we continue to commemorate Women's History Month, we will talk with Kakar about the challenges facing the women of Afghanistan and Iran as they courageously resist their authoritarian government's severe restrictions on their lives. And Palwasha Kakar joins us from the USIP Washington studio via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Carol. I'm happy to be here.
It's a real pleasure and honor to have you. And Palwasha, let's start with your sisters, our sisters in Afghanistan, especially in light of the oppressive conditions for women and girls, the deterioration since the Taliban took over, you know, after 20 years where women had made so many gains. How would you characterize the state of play today? And I think most people know also that Taliban had banned girls from secondary schools. This was about 1 year ago, saying that it would be temporary. But so far, they haven't reversed that policy.
Thank you so much for raising this issue, Carol. It is one that so many Afghan girls and women are worried about, and they're worried about their futures and are so sad about the effects of shutting down the secondary schools and now the universities and not allowing girls to attend. And we're seeing that there was so much hope in the country when there was a possibility for the schools to open, and how that reversal and the shutting down of the schools was impacting not just the girls and the women of Afghanistan, but the men, the fathers, the brothers that also have stood up. We saw that in universities when in December the decree came out and women were told that they could no longer attend the universities. They were actually, some of them were sitting in exams and they were told that they had to leave the exams and get up. They could no longer attend. We saw that their male colleagues also walked out of those exams and stood up for them, and that fathers and other male leaders and tribal elders have also stood up and requested that the Taliban open the girls' schools and women's schools. So it's not just the women of Afghanistan that are suffering, but it's the whole country that is suffering from this crackdown on women and girls' education in Afghanistan.
And I think it begs the question, Palwasha, you know, what is really the rationale behind this? We know that the Taliban haven't really changed that much against many hopes that they might have been a bit more tolerant of women. They talk about religion, but we know that in Islam, there's no real restrictions per se on women's education or the status of women per se. We know in history, Prophet Muhammad's wife, Khadija, was a very prominent businesswoman. Where do they get this? And do they not see that this is depriving them, the government now, of major contributions from, what, over 50% of the society?
That's a really good question, Carol. And I think it's one that we're trying to understand. Part of trying to understand that is to understand that there is diversity within the Taliban and that there's diversity inside of Afghanistan, and understanding that diversity and pinpointing where exactly these decisions are being made. We did see in Afghanistan that when this issue came to vote in the acting government, the acting ministry, ministers in parliament that were appointed by the Taliban, 26 of the 30 ministers voted in favor of the girls' schools to be open. We also saw that there were prominent Taliban religious figures and political figures who came out and talked about the importance of girls' education. We saw that in Paktia, when the community stood up and requested that the girls' schools be open, the fathers, the tribal leaders, the religious leaders stood up and really pushed for the Taliban government to open the girls' schools. The director of education who opened the girls' schools was then taken out of office and put under house arrest. So there is this diversity within the Taliban that we must understand. It's important to understand that there are places where communities are able to negotiate locally, and that space is really important. And it's both on the women's education, but also on the women's ability to be able to work, because there was also the decree that stated that women cannot be working with NGOs, non-governmental organizations. And so immediately after that, there was this discussion, and the acting minister from the Taliban side of the Ministry of Health came out and said, well, this doesn't apply to health NGOs and that women should continue working in that space. And then, of course, in education doesn't apply to women working in primary schools and primary school NGOs. And so it's trying to understand, where do these decisions come from, and how and why these decisions are being made. What I hear is that it's of political in nature. This is not something that's being made, although, you know, at one point they talked about it being religious, and oftentimes they give religious overtones to it being a necessity to protect women's safety and security and their honor, and giving that within couched religious terms. So you have the cultural and the religious. At the same time, we know that it's not cultural, because you have tribal leaders and religious leaders and community leaders overall standing up and demanding that girls' schools be open and also universities be open. So where exactly does this come from? Some speculate that it is from this very extreme viewpoint that originates because these certain Taliban were isolated in pockets of community without many women around them. So it comes from a very misogynistic, elitist perspective around men in terms of how they were brainwashed in their madrasas. But what's really important to understand is it's not across the board. We heard reports of Taliban foot soldiers abandoning their post because they heard about this. So trying to understand where this comes from is important, but also trying to understand what is the international community doing about it. And so we've seen religious authority figures and Muslim countries coming out with statements against what the Taliban is doing related to education. We saw prominent leaders from the OIC come out and speak against this, Azhar University, of course. You know, so we have prominent religious leaders and prominent countries, including Qatar, that supported the Taliban for their Doha office, also come out against this issue. So across the board, Indonesia has come out very strongly against this issue. Saudi Arabia has come out. So we have all of these examples. So why is this not affecting the Taliban? It's not just the international community. It's not just humanitarian aid. It's not development aid. It's not Muslims that are speaking out against it, or religious authorities that are speaking out against it. One little glimmer of hope that we saw in terms of some change on this was when a group of scholars that were quite conservative went to talk to the Taliban, and they were able to get to the point where the Taliban said, okay, we're going to review this curriculum, and in 3 months we'll have an answer about girls' schools and the trajectory in terms of how we will open them. We'll still see. I believe that there's 1 month left on that 3 month period, but we have yet to see whether even that has an impact. And one of the reasons that we need to understand also is that the Taliban's understanding of religious authority and their role in it is that they very much see themselves as leaders, particularly this elitist group that believes very conservatively throughout the Muslim world in the context of Islamist jihadi groups. And so if you look at, for example, the Boko Haram or the Al-Shabaab, they look up to the the Taliban and what they've been able to achieve and their perspective and agree with that. And so within those circles, of course, people agree with what the Taliban have been doing and they see themselves very much legitimized within that group rather than looking at the larger group. But again, I'm using the word they, and I just told you how complex and diverse the Taliban are themselves. And this is a very small group of elite Taliban that are making these decisions and enforcing it. And the rest of the Taliban seem to be going along with it because they believe that they have to follow the emir instead of bring about chaos. But we've seen brave women stand up to the Taliban, not only in local negotiations and conversations about the importance of girls' education or on the media, but also in protest to the Taliban, whether it's in small ways that they can do on their own street or at the university gates or online. There have been numerous ways that Afghan women have been protesting and trying to get their voices heard.
That is absolutely fascinating. When you spoke about the divisions, the tensions within the Taliban, saying that many of the younger ones, the foot soldiers, are actually in opposition to the ban on women attending secondary schools or universities, probably against the ban on working in NGOs. You have also men now sympathizing and working with women inside. So internal as well as external factors from, you know, as far to the religious right as Saudi Arabia, and then, of course, Indonesia, much more moderate in terms of Islam. And then, of course, the West. Let's just hope that the pressure from within and without will eventually wear them down, Taliban, such that this policy will eventually be reversed.
And let me clarify, because we don't have good data coming out of Afghanistan, so I'm not able to say majority of foot soldiers are doing this, but anecdotally, these are stories that we've heard. We have heard that there are people who stand up, there are communities who are upset, and very clearly, some of them have been documented well by the international media, for example, the example I gave for Paktia. But like I said, it's very difficult for us to say how many, because we just don't have good data coming out of Afghanistan, considering the context there and how difficult it is to actually have programs on the ground at this point.
Sure. No, I do understand that. And thank you for clarifying. Let's take a quick break and we'll be right back. You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Palwasha Cocker. She is Director for Religion and Inclusive Societies at the U.S. Institute of Peace. I'm Carol Castiel. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a special shout out to a listener and Facebook fan, Fatih Jahanbakhsh from Iran. And I would like to take this opportunity to wish Nowruz Mubarak to all those celebrating Nowruz and Ramadan Kareem to our Muslim listeners as the holy month of Ramadan gets underway. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. So back to our special guest, Palwasha Cocker, and we're talking about the brave women of Afghanistan, and we'll also be talking about the women of Iran. And actually, let's turn to Iran briefly, Palwasha. We note, of course, the women-led protests in the wake of Mahsa Amini's death last year at the hands of the morality police, who allegedly beat her for improperly wearing the hijab or the head cover. What is your understanding of any progress that is being made on the ground in Iran? And we also know that the protests over the women's, you know, head coverings ignited nationwide anti-regime protests. They morphed into nationwide anti-mullah protests and included men as well. So women, once again, at the vanguard, though.
Thank you, Carol. Really, what we saw out of Iran was just heartbreaking in terms of the way the morality police were cracking down on their own citizens. And after one death of Mahsa Amini, we saw so many other deaths of young women and young men at the hands of these morality police and the brutality of the crackdowns, which was just heartbreaking. We have sort of a regional conversation group between Iranians and Afghan women talking about the situation on the ground. And through these conversations, we heard Iranian women speak to how they feel that the crackdown in Iran is very much being affected by the way the Taliban are behaving in Afghanistan, where the Taliban are being able to get away with such atrocities against women's rights and human rights. And it emboldens the Iranian regime because they're able to do that. that, then the Iranians feel that they can also get away with it on the international stage, and emboldens them to crack down as well. And they felt that there was this modeling between the two where they were feeding off of each other. So when the Taliban would do one thing, Iran would feel emboldened. When Iran would crack down, then the Taliban would feel emboldened to continue to do this. And it seems to have spiraled so much out of control. So that's one thing that I wanted to mention in terms of the conversation between the sisters that have been talking about these protests. Of course, there's been a lot of sharing in terms of how to be effective in their work and how to really raise their issues. But I think in Iran, the society is, and there's so many institutions in place that allow for a different type of protests to happen. So I received, you know, on these channels that I'm on, video clips of how the protests continue, for example, inside of malls, where women will refuse to wear headscarves. And it's not just about what they do on the streets, but just how they are. They go into this mall, they refuse to wear their headscarves, and that is their protest. And the whole mall is mostly full of women not wearing headscarves and just going about their business. And so I think that's something that's not captured by the international media and not captured as, oh, you know, there are women actively protesting on the streets. Well, that's not happening anymore. But there are quiet ways that they're continuing to assert their protest in spaces that have this sort of institutionalized structure of security, where because of the businesses and because of the way the malls function, the government so far has not crossed the line to go in and start, you know, causing problems within the malls and beating down and beating back the women who are not wearing their full hijab or covering their hair, however the Iranian government believes that they should be covering. The other parallels that I've seen here in Washington, D.C., and as we have heard the protests around the world and in Iran and Afghanistan, is also sort of the cadence of the protests, if I might call it that, whether it is Afghan women calling for education, work, freedom. You know, you hear from the Iranian side a similar cadence of what their demands are and how they're doing their protests in similar cadence. And so it's very hard not to recognize those similarities in terms of how the protests are presenting their demands in very simple ways with, you know, women, freedom, and the right. So it's those things that I see that are very similar and parallel. And the sharing that's happened has been really important as these movements continue to build and continue to find ways that are innovative and creative to protest, even though they're being cracked down upon, and to protect the lives and security of those and manage the risk of those that are protesting.
Appreciate your answer. And Palawasha, I want to refer back to the article you co-wrote entitled Iran's Protests and the Afghan Sisters Next Door. You indicate that despite their bravery, Afghan women have also shown resistance, as we just discussed, against even tighter repression of the Taliban. And you mentioned earlier in your answer that Iran was being emboldened in many ways by the Taliban. They're sort of reinforcing each other. Talk about the ways that the Iranian and Afghan women are reinforcing each other. What is the synergy between the movements that each can use to convert their protests and courage into concrete change?
Thank you, Carol. So giving each other moral support, encouraging each other, but also talking to each other about strategies, what's worked, what are some avenues to get their voices heard through? How do you work within the social media sphere to amplify? You know, these are all things that there has been sharing about. What are effective messaging? So on the one side, it's the moral support, but on the other side, it's also the strategic support that we see that's happening between the two. And it's not just people oftentimes assume, well, it's the Iranian women that are helping the Afghan women, but it's both. Both bring experience. As you mentioned, Carol, the way that women have been cracked down in Afghanistan is very different than the way that they've been cracked down in Iran. And so they both bring their experiences from very extreme perspectives and are able to share with each other in sort of in a more peer-to-peer manner rather than, oh, the Iranians have more experience versus the Afghans, or the Afghans have more experience versus the Iranians. And I think that's really important and key to note, because there is this dynamic of the sense that oftentimes, because the Iranians were perceived as sort of a colonial power, if you will, in the region, overshadowing the Afghans. It's really important to be able to manage the way that this is spoken about and speak about it more as an equal relationship between the Iranians and the Afghans and how they're sharing with each other, rather than saying one or the other has a better perspective to share, if that makes sense.
No, that does. Just briefly, real quick, in terms of men, though, the Iranians showed, again, it could also relate to Afghanistan, but from what I gather from your article, Afghan women are also trying to galvanize the men in society. In many ways, they may have gleaned that from the Iranian movement, which, as I said, it morphed into this nationwide anti-regime movement from this terrible killing of Mahsa Amini and many other women just because of the misuse of a headscarf.
Well, to that, I would say that Afghan women have a long history of working with male allies in Afghanistan prior to the Taliban's takeover. You know, they were working with male allies on women's rights issues. Immediately after the Taliban took over, we saw that the protests expanded, and it was not just women, it was men and women across the country protesting the Taliban regime and their crackdown. So, yes, you can see how in Iran, they also have found male allies and men have worked and how it's morphed to this anti-regime movement. In Afghanistan, there also are really great examples of how men have been working alongside of women and supporting women. And I gave you the example of the fathers and brothers standing up and protesting for girls' education in the eastern province of Afghanistan. We also have examples across the board of elders speaking out, even in the south. We have examples of religious leaders, men and women, speaking out. So I wouldn't say that it's necessarily something that the Iranians have a better example of, but it is a learning experience of how do we work together? How do we identify groups? How do we identify messages? How do we work strategically on moving the needle forward on these issues?
Palwasha, does Pakistan help or hurt in this effort to try to reduce oppression by the Taliban and help women in Afghanistan?
So the Pakistan question is one that needs to be parsed out, because you have Pakistan civil society, you have groups like the Pashtun Tahfuz movement, who've stood out very strongly against the Taliban and who have formed alliances with the movement that protests the Taliban crackdown on women's rights in Afghanistan. So, you know, there are various organizations of civil society and women's groups within Pakistan that have strong relations and support Afghan women and their work on the ground. The Pakistan government is another question, and it's one that many Afghans will say that they have not played a positive role, and of course, look negatively on the role of Pakistan in Afghanistan. There's also, you know, this feeling that Pakistan could be doing more. Of course, when we hear from the Pakistan government's perspective, they're very much worried about the TTP and the Taliban support of the TTP. And so they feel that, you know, the Taliban isn't following their will or their suggestions. And so there's this difficulty. We also saw delegations of Taliban ulama, religious leaders and scholars, coming to speak to the Taliban about girls' education. That didn't seem to have much of an effect inside of Afghanistan so far. So the tension within Pakistan between what's going on with Imran Khan and his supporters does not bode well in terms of finding ways that Pakistan can actually support the Afghan people in their struggle for their rights within Afghanistan. There's so many issues that go into that, and so it's quite complex.
Sure.
But I just wanted to lay that out, that there are civil society groups that are working really strongly with Afghan women and Afghan men inside of Afghanistan on women's rights issues, as well as issues related to violent extremism and protection of security and whatnot.
Let's turn back to the United States. You know, we can't go back and change the trajectory of the war, the surges, and ultimately the takeover by the Taliban and the unfortunate messy withdrawal of U.S. troops. But the United States is, at least in word and deed, very much supporting women. We have Rina Amiri, who's our special envoy from the United States. And there's no question that there is this urge and desire to do well by Afghan women, by Afghan civil society. I'm sure there's no other country more regretful about how things turned out after the United States tried very much to usher in a more democratic order. Nonetheless, what would you say, Palwasha, is the U.S. policy toward Afghanistan today, not really officially recognizing, of course, the Taliban, but still trying to get aid in and humanitarian aid to get to the people. What would you recommend that the United States do differently or more of?
Thank you, Carol. First of all, what you stated in terms of the U.S. policy of sanctions against Taliban, the 13 Taliban, and not engaging with the Taliban government formally and only allowing humanitarian aid, I think it's very clear. And thank you for restating that. What I really believe is that the U.S. policy is in supporting the Afghan people and not the government, and wanting the people of Afghanistan to succeed and looking at ways to support the Afghan people in succeeding for their self-determination. So with that in mind, some clear strategy towards that direction would be very helpful. And I believe that there is a big difficulty right now with the banks in Afghanistan, with Afghan people being able to access their money, to be able to have the purchase power, to be able to get their economy back on track. And that has come because of the U.S. and international sanctions against the Taliban. And I think there has been messaging, but of course, more messaging could help. And I know that our State Department colleagues and Tom West and his office is working very hard at trying to clarify the situation and help the economic side of things so that Afghan people themselves can have access to their funds and be able to have a livelihood. In that sense, there's more that can be done to make sure that that happens. On the other side, a strategy that is clearly articulated would be helpful. You know, what does the United States really want from an Afghan government? What are we requesting? And I believe that the Doha Agreement can be a blueprint for a strategy moving forward. The question is whether the U.S. government wants to still hold to that document, the Doha Agreement. And I believe that, you know, what's outlined there in terms of an inclusive government, in terms of security, are still fundamental principles of what we should, as the United States, still want to see out of a government in Afghanistan that also helps the Afghan people. Because when there is an inclusive government that is inclusive of the religious diversity, the ethnic diversity, the tribal diversity, the political diversity that exists, including women, that will strengthen the Afghan people, and they would be able to have a better future. And so it seems to me that what's laid out is something that we can get behind, but I would like to see more of a strategy behind that. And we can see around the world, when there's a clear strategy, it really helps to define priorities in that country and our trajectory towards understanding and how we can support the safety and security, not only of the people that we're trying to help, but also our own safety and security in the United States, defending our own set of values and what we hold dear in terms of our foreign policy agenda.
We have very little time left. So let me conclude by asking you if you're hopeful or cautiously optimistic about the situation in Afghanistan, being able to exploit some of these tensions among the Taliban, galvanizing men and the international community, pushing for women's rights and a better, more inclusive Afghanistan.
I guess I have hope in the Afghan people. I have hope that Afghan people are able to galvanize together and overcome the challenges and difficulties that they face and find creative solutions to move forward. And part of that is creating their own vision for self-determination and working creatively with the tools that they have in their hand to move forward. You know, of course, the Taliban are part of Afghan society, but I think that we have to look at Afghan society holistically in terms of understanding how the way forward could develop. And so I do believe that Afghan society, Afghan people have the abilities and the capabilities to be able to move forward and find a way to self-determination, find a way to overcome these challenges to women's rights, to human rights, to fundamental rights in Afghanistan, to work towards an inclusive government, to work towards a peace, stable, and secure Afghanistan. I do believe that women are a key part of this equation. They have been. What women are doing on the ground is really important and distinctive and really can help shape the country moving forward in unique ways. But I am hopeful in the Afghan people.
Paluasha Kakar is the Director for Religion and Inclusive Societies at the U.S. Institute of Peace. Paluasha, thank you so much for your time. Fascinating insights. We greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Carol.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.